The Blunted Blades. Hello and welcome to episode 26 of this season's Real Football Cast. As always, I'm your host Dan Tracy, and in the next 60 minutes we'll be dissecting all the hot topics in football. As per usual, we'll be discussing what's been going on in the Premier League over the past few days, while in addition to that there are also some off-pitch activities that have caught our eye and they'll be getting our attention in the next hour. It's been another incredible week of football, and this week it is two up top. That means leading the line around the captain's armband is Matthew. So Matthew, how have you been since we last spoke?
Yeah, I've been not too bad. Obviously, slightly, I was going to say disappointed, but you know, succumbed to the inevitable that Fulham's resurgence wasn't going to be able to last forever, and the fact they came against Man City wasn't a big surprise. But yeah, in terms of the overall relegation battle, really not much has changed. So yeah, it's all good. Nothing to be disappointed about.
Well, I'm glad you're doing all right. And also, you're joined by Palace fan Max. Max, I hope all is well. How have you been this past week?
Yeah, really good, really good. The Palace game was nice and positive. I mean, not in terms of the football play, but the result at least. So, you know, you can't get too ahead of yourself. So, yeah, I'm very happy with that.
Glad to hear. Also, I must add that Carl is on a scouting trip this week. So, Carl, if you're listening, I hope all is well. And hopefully he'll be back in the fold next week. Right, I best do the social media bits first. Otherwise, I'll be talking to The Abyss once more. So, first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can. That's on Twitter, at DanTracy1983. Also, the podcast has its own account, which is at Real Football Pod. And if you want to become a shareholder, all you need to do is follow and join our very elite members club. Talking of clubs, I'm delighted to announce that we're now part of the UK's first ever sports podcast network, that being Sports Social. This also means I have my own special podcast page on their website and a swanky media player to replace all the uploads onto SoundCloud. So SoundCloud is a thing of the past. It's all about the social club. You can still find me via iTunes by searching for Real Football Cast. If you use that platform, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And if you like us, leave a review so we move up the league table. I've got to mention my two content partners. If you want betting, predictions, all that kind of stuff, go to betting.com. If you want opinions and thought pieces, go to nowsport.com. And the easiest way to find all the links is by going to linktree.com/realfootballcast. Put a dot between the R and the E. And by doing that, you unlock 10 podcast platforms. It's never been easier to listen to the show. God, these are getting longer and longer each week, but it's a sign of progress, and it's good progress. Right, it's time to go live. And where should we go first? Well, we have to go to Bramall Lane. Now, Matthew, on this show, and I think a lot of people in the wider football fraternity, we all kind of assumed that Chris Wilder was going to be safe for the season. And more than safe, he'd also have a crack at getting them out of the Championship at the first time of asking. However, with Friday's news, that's not the case. Do you think it was genuine mutual consent, or that's a polite byword for an actual sacking?
No, it's as you say, it's a polite byword, because the stories that have come out has basically been a conflict of ideas. The board wanted to impose a director of football, which is the thing these days, whereas Chris Wilder wants to be more of a manager so he can have more control over the comings in and goings out and all that sort of thing. But I reckon it was, you know, a mutual consent, because they obviously recognise what he has done for the club. I don't think anyone can sort of dispute that. But it just came to a bit of an impasse of, as I say, conflict of ideas. Something had to give, and it's much easier to get rid of the manager, especially given the condition they're in. And if you want to go through the whole process of, oh, let's give him some time to work things out so he knows, right, this player's going to be with me in the Championship. He's gone, so I can phase him out. Get this youngster ready because he can be a star in the Championship, whatever. If you give him this time, even if it's in the Premier League, even if it's a terrible team, you've given them some sort of footing. So it does make sense that now... Yeah, I think we've said on the show, as you mentioned, we are a pretty pro Chris Wilder show. We didn't want this to happen, but we sort of thought maybe it could happen. So the timing of it probably works out just about right. It's a shame for Chris Wilder because of what he's done, but in the long term, it's probably the right thing that they did it now.
Okay, then, Max, it did seem that there's been a lack of trust on both sides. The board probably felt, or did feel, that Wilder was no longer the man, especially not the man to get them back out the second tier at the first time of asking. And also, there's kind of reports that Wilder didn't feel he was going to be given the tools to do that job next season. So, you know, Matthew says there's a sacking, which is probably right, but do you think really the relationship has just come to a natural conclusion?
Yeah, I think so. And as Matthew mentioned, we are pretty pro Chris Wilder. I think he was arguably the manager of the season last year, based on the job he did with the group of players that he did. And now, you know, we're seeing this season how good a job it in fact was, because they are a lot of them kind of championship level quality. But I think that the relationship had just kind of run its course a little bit. Basically, from what I understand, the board heavily backed him in getting Sander Berge, who was, you know, about 20 million, I think 22 million, the midfielder. And he's looked a really good player. He's obviously been quite a big loss this season with injury. And so they backed him in that move, even though that wasn't kind of part of their initial plans. I think they just kind of pushed for it quite late in the window. Wilder pushed for it and they backed him. And then they backed him again with Ryan Brewster. And that was another deal approaching 20 million. It's another deal that was kind of outside the proposed budget they'd maybe agreed with Wilder. And Wilder really pushed for it, thinking that if this kid is as good as he looks, and, you know, as much as Liverpool are talking him up and he's doing well in like the England youth teams and all that, he could be the guy who scores 10 goals this season and keeps us up. You know, and then we're looking at selling him on for 50 million in a couple of years. It obviously hasn't worked out like that for various reasons. And so I think there was a lot of tension between the board and Wilder. The board having backed him, outside of their budget by getting Berger and then Brewster. And then Wilder going on a whole rampage saying, oh, you know, I've got championship level players, they're not good enough. And the board was saying, well, we've given you 40 million and, you know, neither of these players have done anything this season. Obviously, Berger's been out injured. But so I think that there was a bit of tension over that. As you mentioned, Sheffield United wanted to introduce a director of football. Wilder wanted a kind of more old school direct control of transfers and all of that. And so I don't think Sheffield United are, you know, completely silly. They recognise what a fantastic job he's done in getting them up and in doing such a good job last season. But I think their styles are just kind of misaligned, and so it makes sense, as Matthew says, to let him go now with the season basically over, and to give the new guy a little bit of a head start in preparing to get them back up again.
So Matthew, in terms of the case for the prosecution, I was going to put forward Ryan Brewster, but Max has just done that. So in terms of his recent comments, do you think those comments have talked him out of a job?
I think there is a case for it, but I think that would be incredibly harsh to, you know, even when you consider all that, to make it to that being, you know, the key reason behind it. I think, and it would be incredibly harsh, because it just doesn't really make any sense when even with those comments, because of, you think he would have had enough credit built up to do so. And even if these are, as you say, championship players, then that makes you think, oh, well, next year when you come, you know, assuming Ryan Brewster isn't for some reason poached by whoever comes up, say Norwich wants someone to replace Timo Pukki and they want Ryan Brewster. So, assuming that they are, you know, as you said, championship players, surely that just would help his cause, because you'd want to think, oh no, these are the players that can take us back up. So if that's the reason that he was gone, then no, that wouldn't really make any sense.
So Max, obviously it's unfair to lay the blame solely on the transfer of Ryan Brewster, but that lack of transfer acumen and the other deals that have been made at Bramall Lane during his Premier League tenure, they've not been great on the whole. You know, also you could argue that potentially, well, losing John Lundstrom on a free transfer at the end of the season is, again, bad business, but that's for a slightly different reason. When you put all those elements into the melting pot, is that the kind of lack of trust when we circle back round, which is going to come from the board and they're thinking, actually, no, we don't really want this man in charge for next season?
Yeah, I definitely think so, because obviously Sheffield United have got ambitions not only to be a yo-yo team, you know, they want to be staying safely in the Premier League. And so to kind of create a sustainable future, you need to have someone in charge who is capable of the recruitment that necessitates. You know, you need to have a manager, basically, who can successfully build a team that is safe in the Premier League. And they obviously didn't feel Wilder could do that. Wilder is unbelievable at making the most of quite a limited squad. And you can say Sean Dyche is quite similar in that regard. He obviously hasn't had a lot of money to spend. But, you know, if Sheffield United do want to stay in the Premier League going forward, they need to be able to get the recruitment right. You know, you can't you really, really can't afford to splash 20 million on someone that doesn't work, like Ryan Brewster. And arguably, if they'd spent 20 million on, you know, maybe a proven striker with potentially less future sell-on value than Brewster, say they bought Origi for 20 million and he scored 10 goals and kept them up, you know, that is literally the difference between staying up and going down. And given his kind of previous history of transfers, obviously Berger is a good player but has been out a lot of this season, I don't think they had the trust in him to do that. You know, he did super well last season, but a lot of those players were from the Championship, and that's a credit to him that he, you know, took them up to that level and they adapted so well. But going forward, I think they probably want someone who's going to get that recruitment right in the Premier League, and maybe that's why they want the director of football.
So Matthew, I know you put up an interesting graphic in our group chat regarding the Blades' decline post-lockdown. Do you think it's as simple as their incredible progress being halted by a global pandemic?
Yeah, I think there is some element to it, because, you know, Sheffield United were, you know, the surprise team last season. You know, everyone sort of expected a little bit of a slump, as it were, you know, second season syndrome, once they've got time to work things out. And I think that was really what it has become. And I think one also reason, and you know, I covered Sheffield United a lot last season for work, and so I listened to some of the reports. They, you know, the general feeling amongst the Sheffield United journalists is they were one of the clubs that, you know, a home atmosphere really does help things. You know, part of the, you know, party atmosphere of them getting promoted and the good feeling around the club, the fact that it was one of their own, Chris Wilder, that's done it, you know, good atmosphere around the club. The fact that that was then taken away, I'm not saying, you know, if Bramall Lane was full, they'd have definitely survived this season, but they probably wouldn't be doing, you know, almost Derby level worthy performances. So I do think that the way things have worked out for them, you can put that down to a factor, arguably a big factor, but probably not the biggest one, but certainly something that should be considered.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's certainly a pertinent reason for their demise. It's also very hard to quantify how many points full attendance would be worth. I think they would probably be closer to you lot, Matthew, than, as you say, that kind of Derby level where they're really stinking out the joint. But at the same time, Max, we must remember that the lack of fandom is league-wide, it's nationwide, so they're not the only club. You know, every club's been affected by such an issue. So ultimately, is this just the sign of a man who took his players as far as he could? And we must not forget that that journey starts in League One.
Yeah, exactly. On the fans thing, it is tricky, and it's obviously so difficult to quantify because it's kind of abstract, and you know, it's impossible to put a definitively accurate number on it. But I think definitely some clubs, although it has been the same for everyone, some clubs it's maybe disproportionately affected because of the atmosphere that they have. And you could say Sheffield United, you could say Leeds, potentially Palace. And then on the other hand, there are some clubs where the lack of fans has maybe decreased the pressure. I'm thinking of maybe West Ham and Man United. So although it is, of course, the same for every team, it's maybe not hitting teams in the same way. But, you know, ultimately, that's not the only reason or the main reason they're going to go down. It's just a factor. But yeah, he did so well on his journey last season. I think maybe there might have been a temptation from the board and from Wilder to think, let's stick with what we have, because this is, you know, this is how well we did last season. We almost got the top half. You know, we were thinking, we were flirting with European football even for a little bit. And so they were maybe thinking, right, well, we don't need to do anything. Yeah, maybe make one signing and then we'll be fine. Whereas Wilder did such an unbelievably good job last season. It was maybe, and they won a lot of tight games. For example, they beat Palace 1-0 in both games, and both of them were very close games. You know, it's not like they played us off the park. They won a lot of games 1-0 or by one goal, and then, you know, that maybe has given them a very slightly false position as well. And so at the start of this season, they're thinking, right, you know, we'll be fine. We were 8th, 9th, 10th for a lot of last season. We don't need to do anything. Whereas that should have been the time when they were really strengthening the squad, maybe getting in a centre-back in case one of their centre-backs got injured. You know, maybe getting a striker with a bit more proven ability in the Premier League. Otherwise, you know, now they're relying on the likes of Brewster and Moussa and Ollie Burke and McGoldrick, who's 33, and Billy Sharp, who's 35. And obviously their lack of goals has been the main the main reason for their downfall. So yeah, I think they last season Wilder took them as far as he could have, and the recruitment this season wasn't good enough, and they're feeling the effects of that now.
So as for the game on Sunday at Leicester, Matthew, really, there's an element of wake regarding proceedings and performance, because with a showing like that, any last hurrah in terms of a change of management this late in the season is certainly not on the cards.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know what the opposite of a new manager bounce is, but that's exactly what Sheffield United got. I mean, in fairness, it was Leicester City, so the result was probably never going to be favourable in their, you know, it wasn't going to be in their favour anyway. But yeah, there did just seem to be, and I've heard a lot of, you know, criticism. I think it was Chris Sutton, one of the more adamant, that basically says that the players just gave up at a certain point, which, you know, in a way kind of, you know, not exonerates, but gives a little bit more credit to the work Wilder's done. Because if the players have sort of resigned themselves to what they were, you know, you can make the argument they were probably resigned to relegation probably at around Christmas time. So the fact that he managed to keep them at least competitive, because I think that was the... I remember seeing a stat that they'd never lost by more than three in the Chris Wilder era. And then as soon as Chris Wilder goes, with, you know, pretty much the same terrible, arguably terrible squad, they go and lose 5-0. So, you know, Chris Wilder probably would have kept them at least competitive in that game, whereas, you know, the argument that Chris Sands, they did just give up at some point when it came to Leicester. But in all honesty, given the situation, you can't really blame them all that much.
No, as you say, I mean, it's no surprise that Leicester won. Maybe the margin is. But Max, in terms of the interim manager or the standing, whatever title he actually has, Paul Heckingbottom can actually prepare the team beforehand due to COVID protocol. But when you look at that second half collapse, the chasm in quality could not have been any more evident.
Yeah, yeah. And I will say as well, obviously Leicester have injuries in attacking areas. You know, Maddison out and Barnes is out, and they're two of the front three for much of this season. So that also provides a little bit of context. But on the other hand, Sheffield United do have a lot of players out injured. Egan is out injured. He's a real defensive leader. And so they're kind of playing Keon Bryan, who wasn't even getting a game in the Championship. And then, you know, Chris Basham, who's getting on for 34. And Ampadu, who's arguably more suited to defensive midfield or midfield rather than centre back. So you know, their defence is really thrown together a little bit. Obviously, Jagielka, who's what, like 38, 39, is getting thrown in as well at other points. And yeah, there's just a kind of supreme lack of confidence. Obviously, losing Wilder just kind of throws everything up into the air. So potentially with their first choice defence all fit, it wouldn't have been so bad. But I think it was just a kind of recipe for disaster, everything coming to a head. And yeah, that'll be the real nadir of their season, probably, because, you know, Wilder, at least when he was in charge, there was the semblance of there being some fight, and, you know, they weren't getting smashed in every single game, maybe only losing by one or two or three. But then, yeah, to lose 5-0, it's really dispiriting, and it doesn't help that Heckingbottom wasn't there beforehand either. All they can hope for the rest of this season is to kind of try and claw some respectability back, make the games at least, you know, an even tight contest, even if they're still losing, and then try and take some of that momentum into next season.
So Matthew, when we talk of quality, Kelechi Iheanacho doubled his league goal tally from 3 to 6 and took home the match ball on Sunday. And you'd have to say it was a really good trio of Leicester goals.
It was an impressive, as you say, an impressive trio and a very good performance. You know, there's a lot of talk, you know, that's come off the back of it, that, you know, Iheanacho has now put himself, he's auditioning very well to be Jamie Vardy's replacement, because Jamie Vardy is 34, I want to say, at this point. So his time as Leicester's talisman is going to be dwindling down. So Iheanacho, who hasn't really been given much of an opportunity to play because of Jamie Vardy, but now with the injuries to Barnes and Maddison, all that lot, he's been given a more of a chance to get more minutes under his belt, and he's proving to be, you know, a pretty decent player. So he's taking his opportunity well, but I do think some of it does need to be quantified with the fact that it was Sheffield United, you know, for all the reasons that we've previously discussed. You know, had it been against had it been against Fulham, for instance, or even someone like West Brom down the bottom, I don't think he would have been given as many great opportunities to score as he did against Sheffield United. So a very good performance. He's made himself, got himself some headlines, but just in their overall concept, I'm not going to automatically saying that he's no Ballon d'Or favourite or anything like that just yet.
Okay then, Max, if Matthew's sort of tempering his scout report, how good a striker is Iheanacho? I believe Manchester City put a buyback clause on the Nigerian when they sold him for, what, 25 million. Will Leicester ever have to be concerned about that being activated?
I don't really think so. Although, you know, to be fair, he has had limited opportunity. And I suppose if Leicester do want someone in the kind of maybe third striker, cup competitions kind of role, then he could fit the bill. Obviously, he's been there before. He's come up through their system. And at the moment, they're obviously very thin on the ground with strikers. Aguero is likely to leave. Now, they're obviously likely to replace him as well. But then, you know, Jesus might get to a point where he's thinking, well, if I'm just going to be a number two striker, that's not enough for me. I want to go and start for a European team at continental level or something like that. Then Iheanacho could well be a number two or number three. But it is early days. They were all nice finishes against Sheffield United. But ultimately, he's been out of the team for a reason. And you can say, yeah, he hasn't had much of a chance. But then when he has had a chance, he hasn't taken it so far until the last couple of games. He played against Palace, I think, last season or earlier this season. And he was very quiet and missed a penalty. And so, you know, when Vardy's been out or, you know, that they've rested him because he's played in the European games, he hasn't yet done enough. And he's just kind of starting to turn it on now. So he needs to reproduce it on a much more consistent basis if he's going to move back to Man City. But he could very, very well become Vardy's replacement, in inverted commas. You know, they're different kind of players, and he's not going to be able to replicate Vardy's on the shoulder and running and pressing and all of that kind of thing. But he can definitely become Leicester's first choice number one striker. Yeah, talks of return to City probably a bit premature, although it might happen.
Well, you mentioned Iheanacho as a replacement for Vardy, and the theory on Match of the Day 2, without ripping them off completely, is that Leicester might have to evolve and change shape slightly, and that if they try and look for a direct replacement, that might not work. But if they change their style a little bit to bring out the best of Iheanacho on a week-to-week basis, that's how Leicester can kick forward. But we need to move on, because we need to talk about the North London Derby and a whole lot more. So let's go to the Emirates. And Matthew, on the face of that performance, you'd have to say that Arsenal were the deserved winners.
Yeah, they were. And I think it's merely down to Tottenham's sort of downfall. And I know a lot of talk going into it is, you know, as it has been throughout the rest of the whole of the season, is Jose Mourinho has got, you know, he plays too defensive and he doesn't let the hand break off, I think is one of the more common phrases. And you saw that really on Sunday, because it's somewhat hampered with Son Heung-min's injury, kind of had to tweak that dynamic front three of Kane, Son and Bale. So Jose Mourinho was sort of forced into a more defensive minded thing because he couldn't really unleash the front three as he wanted to. But overall on the day, absolutely, you'd have to say Arsenal, you know, were the more dominant and the better team and deserved their victory, which is a huge boost for them when you consider, yeah, it's not, again, one of the narratives, it's not, you know, a changing of the tides in terms of North London or anything like that, but just in terms of what they needed in terms of trying to get their season back on some level of success, the fact that they can go right and say, right, they put in a decent performance against Tottenham, yeah, a massive boost for them going forward and something they're going to need mentally going into their Europa League campaign.
Well, that's exactly it. You know, ignore the league, because really, in terms of where Arsenal finish, it's pretty much irrelevant, but that's a massive boost, a shot in the arm, if you will, for their Europa League hopes. And if they meet again in that competition, then who knows what will happen. But Max, in terms of Tottenham's only highlight, we know what it is. It's Eric Lamella and that incredible goal. I mean, it looked beautiful. You could describe it as disgusting almost in its ludicrous nature. But when you look back at it, is it going to be lost in time within the context of the game for the simple reason that Spurs lost and he got sent off?
I don't think so. You know, you always have that memory, even if it is in a loss. For example, I just make everything about Palace, don't I? Had Andros Townsend's, you know, volley against City, that wonder strike came against City, and we eventually lost 3-2. I don't think it diminishes the strike in itself. Obviously, he did get sent off later. It's the most Eric Lamella thing of all time, isn't it? You know, score Rabona and then get sent off and Tottenham lose. But I don't think it necessarily takes away from the quality of the strike. Obviously, it kind of mars the day overall. My mate and I often have debates about Lamella because my mate, he's a Tottenham fan, absolutely loves him and thinks he's a quality player. I'm not so enamoured with him because basically you can tell Lamella has a lot of talent, which is, you know, typified by that Rabona strike, but he's not consistent enough with it because a player of his talent should really be starting for Spurs. And, you know, at the moment, he's played a lot of the season behind Bergwijn and Lucas and players who arguably don't have the same kind of natural talent that he has. He needs to be able to turn that on more often. But, yeah, I don't think the fact you lost will ever take away from that strike. You know, that'll still make it onto Sky Sports highlight reels and all of that. And, yeah, what a strike it was.
Well, it's definitely one for Premier League years. You know, the episodes that's always on loop across Sky Sports in the day. So give it a couple of years and that'll be on repeat, no doubt. But Matthew, the key moment in that game was undoubtedly the penalty decision regarding Davinson Sanchez and Alexander Lacazette. Now, it's part air shot, part slice through the player. For you, did it clear what was needed to be the penalty threshold?
I think it did. And I've gone back and forth over this, as I'm sure everyone else has, because when everyone first saw it on TV, even the Sky commentators did, thought it was one of the best blocks that they've ever seen from Davinson Sanchez. And everyone would say, oh, what a fantastic block. Then he gives a penalty. So it was John Cross as well on Twitter was saying, oh, this will definitely be overturned. And then the footage comes through. It's like, oh, Lacazette, yeah, complete air shot. But so I'm thinking, yeah, probably penalty. And even so, I know it's not the most clear and obvious, but I think Davinson Sanchez in that situation, he gave the referee a decision to make, and he didn't really make it the hardest one. So again, in the world of clear and obvious error, the fact that a penalty was already awarded enough to overturn it, I'm not 100% sure. You know, Lacazette, you know, kind of helps the situation by the fact that he scuffs the ball. But the way Davinson Sanchez charges in what you can argue it's reckless the way he did it. You know, you could even argue dangerous to an extent. So given that whole parameter, I think, yeah, penalty's definitely the right decision.
Okay then, Max, is a more important point in this that Mark Oliver didn't go to VAR. Now, that's his right. With that, is that a man in complete confidence of his own ability, or is there an element of arrogance in his refusal to go to the touchline technology?
I think that it's fine for a ref to say, no, I'm happy with my decision, if he is genuinely very happy and confident with it. But I think it definitely warranted looking at. I'm a little bit on the fence about whether it was a penalty or not, but I don't think it was so cut and dry, it was so clear that he could say, yeah, no, I'm definitely sure we don't need to look at it. If it was a circumstance where, you know, 95% of people would agree that it was a penalty or not a penalty, and it was a bit more obvious what the right decision was, then it's all right for referees to say, no, actually, I don't think we need to have a look at it. But, you know, in the North London derby, in a very controversial incident, you know, one is likely to turn the game and give one team the potential winner. I think it was basically too close to call for the referee to then say, oh, no, you know, we don't need to have a look at it. It definitely warranted looking at.
Well, yeah, for me, with my Tottenham hat on and a little bit of bias, I've got no issue if Oliver has a look at the TV monitor and says it's a penalty. And then that way, you know, you can sort of say, OK, well, he's given the decision, he's backed it up. There's not a lot to argue about, even if you felt it was a penalty or not. It's just that kind of slightly ambiguous nature to the decision. You know, as Matthew has quite rightly put, on the balance of probabilities, it probably is a penalty. But I personally would have just liked that extra level of confirmation. You know, it's there, why not use it? And it takes away all these talking points and doubts. But it is what it is, and we move on. Because going into that game, it was set up quite nicely for Tottenham, if only to take advantage of the slip-ups the day before. None more so than at Goodison Park. And Matthew, we've said time and time and almost time again, the thing with Everton is that their inconsistency is always, always going to be their undoing.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was, again, evidenced with the way they performed against Burnley. And again, I don't want to spend this Burnley putting a good performance. We don't want this to always be about, you know, against about Everton.
Of course.
But there is just that level of, No, some of it isn't really down to their fault. You know, I'm sure that the change, the fact they had to bring Jordan Pickford off, probably didn't help things, because that's one less substitution that you could bring on to change the game later on, sort of thing. Didn't help things. But yeah, as we've said all the time this season, there will just be that one blip that Everton will always, just as soon as you start to think, oh, they can do it, something will, I don't want to make the direct comparison, but there was something Spursy about them. Just as soon as something is about to go good for them, they will drop off and they will make it hard for themselves. You know, everyone was saying that they're going to be making a push for the top four this season, whereas now I think the top four for them is probably pretty much gone, especially given, as you know, we would expect there to be another blip further down the line that will cost them. So then best chance now is probably just to aim for the Europa League, if they can even get that.
Well, exactly. If Liverpool get their house in order, which with the players they have looks more likely than unlikely, and then you're sort of thinking, is top six even in the mix for the Toffees? But last week, the three of us had a debate about goals and what we viewed as the most pleasurable and the most aesthetically pleasing. Now, I don't know about you, Max, but I thought the Dwight McNeil goal was incredibly easy on the eye.
Yeah, it was lovely to watch, wasn't it? And it was quite funny to see Dyche say after the match he was shouting at McNeil not to shoot, because it was the, I suppose, the low percentage option rather than kind of passing to one of the strikers. But yeah, he is, without wanting to sound disrespectful, I think he's a bit too good for Burnley. And I'm not saying that out of a kind of an inflated sense of my own club's importance. I can easily say that Zaha and probably Eze are too good for Palace, but McNeil is too good for Burnley. He's top class. And I'm really surprised he wasn't named in the England under-21 squad. Now, I'm not sure if that's because he might be just over the age boundary, but he's talented enough to be in the mix for the under-21s, at least, because he's starting regularly for a Premier League team, and he's by far the most creative and effective force for them in attack going forwards. And so, yeah, he's just a class player, and he showed how good he is. I would not be surprised if he isn't at Burnley in a year or two's time.
Well, the argument around him is that he doesn't get enough goals, but you could also temper that by saying perhaps the system he plays in doesn't allow him to do that. It'd be interesting to see what he could do with, not better players, that's unfair to Burnley, but you know, slightly more technical, skillful players, and would that bring even more out of him? Of course, we don't know that answer if and when he moves on. But Matthew, with Everton failing to make up any ground on Chelsea after their 0-0 draw at Elland Road, it was also a rare draw for Marcelo Bielsa's men. Only the third of the season in the league. I don't think anyone would have put a stalemate on their weakened coupon.
No, I don't think they would, but I think it's just one of the, you know, Leeds results, because we know that Leeds can often perform very, you know, in their erratic season as they have been. We know that Leeds against some of the big sides can prove to be, you know, troublesome for them. Like they were pretty, like Man City, I think Man City only managed to get a draw out of them.
That's right.
Early in the season, they got a draw against Arsenal. They gave Liverpool a right good fright on the first day of the season. So we know that Leeds, given that on any given day, Leeds can put in a great performance against a big side. And I think this is just one of those occasions where the two big sides sort of cancelled each other out, because we know the good job that Thomas Tuchel has done, not revolutionising, but certainly improving Chelsea after Frank Lampard had gone. So I think it's literally just, it was always going to come eventually, as has been hinted at earlier in the season, and it just so happened to come on a day like this. So I think I wouldn't expect there to be many more coming forward, but I'm at the end of the day, I'm also not surprised that it happened.
So Max, it's now 10 straight games unbeaten for Chelsea in the league, and it's fair to say that Thomas Tuchel's being a little bit stingy with the entertainment. You know, it's pragmatic, there's no doubt about that, but when you're sort of looking through your weekend's fixtures, Chelsea aren't really jumping off the page anymore. So the thing is, if you were to look at that football and Jose Mourinho was in charge of Chelsea, or even at Spurs, that kind of brand, you'd be moaning about the low block, the buses fully parked, etc., etc. So why is the German not being given the same tag of negativity?
Very simply, because he's winning. you know, if he had been playing this style and they were not getting the results, then, you know, rightly, there would be fans and pundits saying, well, you know, how have you improved the club? You know, you're kind of shackling the attacking talent that we've got. You're playing a system that only allows two, you know, attacking midfielders or wingers behind the striker, which is, you know, not making the most of the riches that you have compared to some of the other teams in the division. And, you know, you're not getting the results. But the results speak for themselves, and everything is fine, and you can look over everything if you're winning. You know, Chelsea fan can have, you know, maybe some justifiable concerns, slight concerns about the style of play and maybe the slight negativity. But at the same time, Tuchel will say, well, look at all these games I've won. Look at how far I've climbed the table. You know, we're well in the top four spaces, and, you know, barring a collapse, we're likely to finish there as well. And so I think, you know, fans, although they can have maybe some slight concerns, the results have been good enough that he can avoid any real criticism.
Well, this is it, Matthew, isn't it? Because ultimately, if you're a points over performance man, it doesn't really matter. You know, if you're getting the job done, which they are, there's very little validation for an argument. And if Chelsea do get into the top four, as is looking likely, the ends will justify the means.
Yeah, absolutely. No, you say I'm definitely a points over performance man. So likewise, I think there is some element to it, which is why Frank Lampard, you know, was given the go. You know, as much as, you know, there's the emotional tie, and, you know, he's doing well bringing the youngsters through, and he got a little bit of leeway for the way the transfer window was sort of stacked against him, and all that sort of stuff. But at the end of the day, the points weren't there, so you get rid of him. Whereas with Tuchel, the points are there. It may not be the most glamorous, but, you know, there are some teams that can put in points and performance. You know, like Liverpool have been, not this season, but previously, Manchester City are entertaining and put up points. So ideally, you want both. But at the end of the day, if you have to sacrifice one, then you get rid of the performance and you just focus on the points.
Absolutely. I mean, in an ideal world, we'd all love to see our team playing the most free-flowing football and getting 3 points every week. But we all know that in most cases, that's not feasible. And as you say, Matthew, most logical people would say, out of the two, I'll have the points, please. There are some people who are, shall we say, you know, they look at football through a different lens, and there's nothing wrong with that, and they'll like to lose in that graceful manner. But for me, no. You know, you want to be getting the job done by hook or by crook. So, as you say, Matthew, they are going about it the right way. And Max, when you look at the context of the weekend, by the end of Saturday lunchtime, it's 2 points dropped, and Chelsea fans are probably thinking the worst. Come the end of the weekend, it's actually a point gained on everyone else.
Yeah, very much, very much. And, you know, as we've mentioned before, Leeds can pull out a big result against anyone because of the kind of unique and individual style that they play. They've got a lot of really talented attackers. And, you know, some of their games can be a bit crazy, and, you know, you can rack up loads of goals, and they're quite unpredictable, basically. And so, you know, I think Chelsea will be happy that they managed to stifle Leeds' attack, which is kind of unique system to deal with everyone kind of bombing forward. And yeah, a point is a point. You have to respect the point. Maybe when you're Chelsea or a big team, you have the mentality that you should be winning every game, and that's fine. You know, that's understandable, and it's good to aim for that. But if you can't win, make sure you don't lose. And lots of other teams around them have lost, and so in the grand scheme of things, people who are saying, oh well, you know, I can't believe we haven't beaten Leeds and all of that, at the end of the weekend, as you say, they'll be thinking, actually, we've done pretty well here, considering that a lot of the teams around us haven't done so well, and given the form that they've been on, I think there's absolutely no problem with a draw, clean sheet, move on to the next one, and, you know, keep that barrier between yourself and the teams below you. Yeah, decent result.
Absolutely. I mean, now it's all about just distance, isn't it? You don't really have to be barnstorming every week. It's all about accumulation of points, and if it's a point more than everyone else across a week, then that's a victory in itself, and so on and so forth. So they're doing the right things, annoyingly, because I hate talking about Chelsea in a positive light, but I have to. Talking of negativity, Matthew, it's over to you now, because the relegation pendulum just swung in the opposite direction over the past few days. Now, I know you tempered the mood after the Liverpool win. You sort of said, hang on, let's like rein it in a bit. We're not going to go on a monster run now. But with that said, shooting yourself in the foot defensively is going to sting somewhat.
Yeah, it will, and that's probably the only annoying thing is the fact that, you know, all of them were pretty much, you know, could have been prevented. You know, John Stones for the first goal, you know, easily loses his marker, arguably could have done defensive there. The second one was catalogue of errors from a whole bunch of people. Anderson slips over, the clearance hits Cavalera and just falls into the path of Jesus. And then the third one is a pretty obvious penalty. So there's not much that can be said there. If we'd have, you know, if we'd have gone down by a, I know he wasn't playing, but a Kevin De Bruyne 35-yard strike, you hold your hands up and say, that's all we can really do. But it was slightly annoying the fact we lost in that way. But in the overall scheme of things, it doesn't really make that much of a difference because, and I've been saying this for a couple of days now, basically after Newcastle's draw with Aston Villa, is that at the end of the day, we're still back to where we were because the way that the media references it every single game, and, you know, it's the one that we, you know, we as Fulham fans are looking forward to. It's that last game of the season against Newcastle. So long as we can keep ourselves within distance of that, then we'll fancy our chances on the last day of the season because we reckon we'll win that. So from the start, when Newcastle United kicked off on, you know, on Friday night to where we are now, all they've done is gain 1 point. So the gap is now 2 points rather than 1 point. But if you look at it, you know, for the last day of the season, you know, we would need to beat them anyway because, you know, if we got a point, they get a point, so we'd take it anyway. So we're still in the situation where a win on the last day of the season, assuming we match results, keeps us up. So at the end of the day, not much has changed, which is why I'm not overly disappointed with how the week, weekend has gone.
Well, this is in my notes, Max, because really the objective for Fulham is just to keep Newcastle at arm's length, because as much as they'd like to be 17th right now, they don't have to be. It's all about making sure that Newcastle are no more than 2 points clear, or three, if Fulham have a better goal difference on the final day. And if that's the case, then we get, really, a de facto relegation playoff.
Yeah, very much so, very much so. And yeah, obviously they'd like to get ahead of Newcastle by that point to give themselves a little bit of a buffer. But it's not the end of the world if they don't, because as you say, they know they've got that game against Newcastle on the last day. And the way that Newcastle are playing and the way that Fulham are playing, you would back Fulham to win that. We don't often see a kind of a last day relegation playoff where it's one team or the other. We often have it where one team is playing and then another team that's in danger is playing somewhere else, and you've got kind of two games going on in parallel. But to have that kind of intensity in one game, I mean, for a neutral, it's quite exciting. It must be super nerve-wracking for Fulham and Newcastle fans if that is the game that decides it. But yeah, you're right. You know, Fulham won't, their season won't be defined on their results against Man City. So, yeah, I understand it's frustrating to concede goals like they did, but that's been very rare for them. You know, they've been pretty good defensively recently. And so, yeah, you put that one behind you, you move on, you're always unlikely to get something out of the Man City game, even if you defended perfectly to the best of your ability. So as long as they're within reach of Newcastle on that final day, Fulham will feel justifiably that they've got a really good chance of staying up.
Am I right in thinking that the last, just to interrupt you, Dan.
Yeah, yeah.
Am I right in thinking the last relegation playoff was Sheffield United Wigan in 06-07? I can't remember. I think that may be the most recent one. I don't think there's been one where it is two teams on
yes,
the final day.
That
no,
rings a bell.
No. I tell you what, it was Blackburn Wolves in 2010-11.
Yes.
That was it. Because they played, because Wolves, Matt Blackburn won 3-2. But that result kept them both up. So the last 5 minutes, they just kicked the ball around for the last 5 minutes. That one I remember. Yeah, sorry to interrupt. Yeah, that was the last one.
That's right. I was going to ask, actually, in terms of, shall we say, relegation playoffs, do you think the Championship playoffs should be rejigged slightly? So sixth place isn't a part of it, and 18th in the Premier League then enters the semi-finals and has to play for their survival. What do you think of that, Matthew?
I think it's a good idea in principle. But I just can't see anybody really nominate. I know it works around the continent. I know Germany do it. I know Holland, the Netherlands rather do it. I'm sure there's other countries that. But no, I just quite like the symmetry of it. You know, the fact that it's within your tier, it's within your division that everything's kept. I do quite like that. It's a nice idea, but it's just not for me.
That's fine. Max, are you a fan of cross-league playoffs?
I mean, it would probably make it more exciting for everyone who wasn't involved in it. Maybe I'm just being a bit of a Luddite and kind of, because I don't know it, I'm not behind it. But yeah, I don't think so. Not for me. Although, you know, if it did happen, then I'd kind of watch it with interest.
Okay. I mean, it actually used to be a thing back in the, where are we in history? Late 80s, I believe, when they were trying to make the leagues bigger. I think the first division had 20 teams. They wanted to gradually get to 22, but they did so by having promotion relegation playoffs for two seasons. There's one for the history books, but then they scrapped it and brought in the playoffs that we see now. So it has happened in the past, but I'd be surprised if it came back in the near future. Right.
That being said, though, just quickly, if we're inventing new playoffs, I don't know how the maths of it would work, but I would like to see a Champions League playoff. So the team that comes first wins the league, gets Champions League, fine. But then if we're playing for the last three spots, have second v seventh.
Yeah, that'd be
third
right.
Third v sixth, yep. Fourth v fifth. Have those two over two-legged playoffs. Then, you know, winners get the Champions League, losers get Europa League.
Oh, we might be on something there, actually. Right, UEFA, if you're listening, let's talk. But let's also talk about the positives elsewhere in the wider relegation picture. Burnley, we referenced earlier. So let's focus on Brighton now. And Matthew, they didn't really have to rely on luck, which they had none of, the last few weeks. They didn't have to rely on luck against Southampton. It was simply a well-measured performance against the Saints.
It was, and as you said, there are days when you're down the bottom where your luck is against you, and you know the game against West Brom was exactly that. But it just goes to show, you know, Brighton have, you know, over the past couple of seasons, you know, even with Chris Hughton, they've always done enough. They haven't really lit the Premier League alight. They've just sort of been there, but eventually, over the course of the season, and when push comes to shove, they will just about get themselves over the line. And this was just one of those results. Again, partly, you know, if you want to put luck into it, the fact that they managed to get it against Southampton, who are in a bit of a state at the moment, not exactly in the best of form. But, yeah, a good performance all around from there and a thoroughly well-deserved 3 points.
And Max, we've just mentioned sort of Newcastle in their final day trying to avoid that playoff scenario. They might help themselves this weekend because they face Brighton, and I think now we're in that sort of territory where this really is a relegation 6-pointer.
Yeah, it's absolutely massive. Obviously, most people would say West Brom and Sheffield United are down, and then Fulham are on 26, right? Brighton and Newcastle, their game in hand over Fulham is against each other, or, you know, one of the games in their running is against each other. And it's absolutely huge because Newcastle are only 2 points ahead of Fulham, Brighton are only 3 points ahead of Fulham. If one team wins it, then they can really put themselves quite far clear from Fulham for the rest of the season. But if it's a draw, they're kind of both still in danger. So I think we could get a really good game where both sides are going to be desperate to try and win it because they know how important it is. Alternatively, on the other side of the coin, you could get both sides desperate to lose it and they play out a really boring 0-0. But I'm hoping it will be the former. But yes, it's an absolutely massive game. And yeah, I was a little bit disappointed, obviously, being a Palace fan, that Brighton managed to get that result over the line, because had they lost that to Southampton, who obviously have been in terrible form but have got a lot of good players and, you know, were doing really well earlier in the season, then, you know, they would have been right down there with Fulham as well. They would have only been above Fulham and outside the relegation zone on goal difference. So yeah, I was a bit disappointed to see that, but you know, even I have to admit they probably did deserve it, and they've deserved probably more points from their last couple of games as well.
Okay then, Max, I'll stay with you, because if there is a winner between Newcastle and Brighton, does that bring Southampton into the mix, or does the winner just get themselves an extra buffer from Fulham? You know, how does this sort of all pan out? Are there teams that are watching with a little bit more interest on that game?
I mean, Southampton and Burnley, if they lose their last, you know, six or seven of their last nine, then they could potentially be dragged into it. But, you know, they're both on 33 points. Traditionally, 38 points is about enough to stay up. So they only need, you know, one win and a couple of draws from their final nine. And then even if they lose six of their last nine, you know, they should still be all right. So I think it's probably, on the balance of probability, it's probably too far for Southampton or Burnley to be overhauled. To be honest, I suspect it's going to be one of Brighton, Newcastle and Fulham who stay up.
Yeah, I think it'd be unlikely for Southampton or Burnley to get really dragged in. They're not safe yet. They're not on the beach, as we say. No need for the towels just yet. But when you're looking at candidates, I think it's from that trio, isn't it? So, Matthew, of that trio, there was high drama on Tyneside last Friday night. It looked like Newcastle were going to get nothing from their clash with Aston Villa. But I guess credit to them for finding a goal late on after conceding late themselves.
I don't want to give too much credit to Newcastle. Given the begrudging respect. But you know, as we said with Sheffield United, you know, there is a point where, you know, given Newcastle United's recent form and the way, you know, it could be, you know, they could have just not downed tools, but they could have just, you know, sat back, accepted the defeat, and just here we go again, sort of thing. But the fact that they managed to dig deep and managed to get themselves a last minute equaliser, you know, it's going to be important for them, you know, not just on the one game managing to get the point that, you know, come the end of the season could be absolutely huge, but also a mental boost, because now Steve Bruce can sort, and he's sort of hinted at that with what he said today. He can look at it and say, right, you've shown in the past, you've shown against Aston Villa that you're not just giving up. You haven't given up just yet. You can still fight for this. So I think that's going to be just as important moving forward as it was, you know, on Friday night. And I think that's going to be huge for them.
Okay then, Max, Aston Villa, there's no doubt they've had a good season up until a point, but that point is kind of the high watermark. They're not really going to improve that. So is it fair to say they're running out of steam now? 2 points from the last nine on offer. It's kind of much improvement on last season, but that European dream is fading away.
Yeah, definitely. Much improved. But I think, yeah, they were maybe overperforming based on their early season form. Or you can just say, well, it shows what a massive loss Jack Grealish is. And obviously Matty Cash as well, because Al-Mohammadi is obviously not up to the standard that Cash is. But yeah, they've definitely struggled creatively. Although, to be fair, Ollie Watkins, who is just on a one-man mission to set Semi over the edge when I'm watching him, because he's in my fantasy team and he just always hits the bar about 14 times in every single game whenever he's playing, just to give me false hope. He's also had like four goals disallowed for VAR tight calls and all that. Anyway, but yeah, they've struggled creatively without Grealish. He's obviously a massive loss, in the same way that Zaha would be to Palace, and, you know, Antonio is to West Ham and stuff like that. I think they've shown that they're not quite at that level, because a really properly good European contender team would find a way, even without Grealish, you know, to get Traore and El Ghazi and Barkley into the team. But Grealish is kind of the glue that knits them all together. And they've shown that without him, they really do struggle. And had he been out for the whole season, obviously that would have been massively bad luck. But they could be a lot further down towards the bottom end. So, yeah, I think they're finishing about where they should, based on the quality that they had. Where they were early in the season is potentially a little bit above what they're capable of.
OK then, Matthew, has this marked improvement done enough to keep Jack Grealish at the club for next season?
Yeah, I think there is. You can look at it. You can look at it and say, you know, this is just how important Jack Grealish is to the club. So, you know, both sides can sort of say that, you know, if we're all together and if we can all stay like this, then we can move forward as a club. Obviously, you are an important part of that. But to supplement that, we'll also go and get you, you know, another couple of players to help you, you know, take some of the load off you. So if Matty Cash, for instance, is injured, then we can get you another right back so that you've always got a decent right back to play with, sort of thing. So I don't think it may sort of hurt them because they're not pushing up as far up the table, but it sort of gives both sides a little bit of leeway to say we can do something as long as we all stick together, and that will involve keeping Grealish as part of the side.
Well, Max, when you think about it, Villa don't need to sell financially. They are much better up the league table than they were last season. That's a lot of ticks in the box for Grealish to stay. You'd be quite surprised, and I think Villa fans would be confident that he stays this summer.
Yeah, I think they should be. I think they've definitely shown enough to show that, you know, with maybe a couple of acquisitions and maybe strengthening the squad a little bit, a backup to Watkins, namely, maybe backup to Cash and Target and the likes of those kind of positions, I think they can definitely easily finish in the top half, and then potentially, I think it might be a little bit early to talk about European qualification, but you know, in two or three seasons, if they get their recruitment right, they could be pushing for sixth and seventh and Europa League spots and that kind of thing, and you know, potentially be looking at a domestic cup. So had they had a season like last season where they kind of narrowly avoided relegation, I think that would have been curtains for them in terms of Grealish leaving. But there is no reason for him to leave at the moment. He definitely could play at a higher level, and he would start for a lot of teams above where Villa are likely to finish around mid-table. But they've showed enough progress that they'll be confident of keeping him.
Okay, it's the quickfire round. We've got about 3 or 4 minutes to go. So, Matthew, Liverpool returned to winning ways on Monday night as Diogo Jota scored against his former club. But should Wolves have a penalty when Alisson clattered Nelson Semedo in the box?
No, I don't think so. I think that's the sort of accidental damage. I think given what Alisson was doing, he was going up for the ball, following a cross, and he just dropped it. And I think if you're giving a penalty for that, you're being incredibly harsh on Alisson there. It's a football, to borrow a term from American football, it's a football play. It's just part of the way they get. There was no malice involved. It was just a coming together. Let's just put it that way. I don't think you can really award a penalty for something like that.
Yeah, if we go back to our penalty threshold, I don't think it's crossed. So I think the right decision was made there. Max, Palace got the job done against West Brom with a penalty of their own. I think the game was functional rather than fantastic. But in terms of Premier League status, I think it's all but secure for another season.
Yeah, very much functional, but... yeah, if not fantastic, as it is a very good summation of what happened. Yeah, Palace will consider themselves safe, basically. Although Hodgson and the players won't admit that, I think they will consider themselves safe. That obviously leaves West Brom in a lot of trouble. That would have been one of the games they targeted winning in. And, you know, they had their moments and a couple of good chances. But, yeah, I think that ultimately they're down. And even if they'd won... at the weekend, I think that they would have still been likely to go down. But yeah, now it's basically a chance for Palace to, although, you know, we're not mathematically safe yet, and so we're not going to take our foot off the gas, but it's a chance for Palace to try and let the handbrake off a little bit, to use a term that Spurs fans do with in reference to Mourinho's style of play, because we are pretty much safe now. And unless we lose like eight of our last nine games and go on a horrendous run like we did last season, to be fair, but we've now got the chance to basically... let the handbrake off a little bit, let the shackles off, and try out a kind of a new, more ambitious and attacking and creative and exciting style of play. Because ultimately, both the players and the manager are auditioning for, you know, to be there next season, because I think a dozen players are out of contract, and as are Hodgson and all the coaching staff. And as much as we're happy to get the win against West Brom, it was pretty dour, you know, not many chances against a team that is, you know, one of the worst in the division. And if we carry on like that, you know, picking up the odd result by the odd goal, but, you know, not really impressing and not really creating many chances, I think Palace will be likely to let Hodgson go, or potentially keep him as the safe option for next season if no managers in the market are available. But, you know, Palace definitely aren't on the beach, because both the players and the manager have got something to prove to show that they should be there next year. And very quickly on the Alisson penalty, I don't think it was a penalty. And I think you can file the Davinson Sanchez challenge on Lacazette as the same thing as Matthew was talking about. No malice in it, just a coming together. Yes, there was contact, but the ball was already gone. So I don't think that was a penalty either.
Where's the consistency? That's all I ask. But anyway, I'll take Man United versus West Ham. And apologies to Craig Dawson, who is the latest player to be jinxed by our England rattle. First up, Harvey Barnes. He gets injured. Craig Dawson scores the important own goal that gives United 3 points. So if you're a England prospect and you want to get into the Euros, you don't want to rattle from us. You have been warned. Right, on that note, I just need to do the admin and thank my two Pod Squad members. Max, a fantastic performance as always. Thanks for your time this afternoon.
Yeah, thanks very much. See you next week.
Cheers, mate. And of course, Matthew, a pleasure to have you on board. Thanks to you as well.
Yep, pleasure as always. Happy to be here.
Fantastic. Cheers, guys, and also to the listeners out there. And with that said, it just leaves me to say that my name's Dan Tracy. This is The Real Football Cast. And until next time, goodbye.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.